Hello, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. Carrie Gillam will be joining me. She is the investigative journalist and author behind the book, The Monsanto Papers. And I am so excited to have her on because I was following that legal battle. And I've been following the work of Monsanto for so many years. So it's really a thrill to be able to have some time to talk with her. But before she comes on, I want to share some things with you going on in the news, some ways that you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. So first, I wrote this week in my newsletter about shifting our food system to healthier food. And there's actually an opportunity in New York State. A bill was presented to the legislation to choose more plant-based foods for institutions. And that are institutions like universities, public healthcare facilities, correctional facilities, and encouraging them to purchase more plant-based foods. And as we know, this would not only be good for the planet, but it would also be good for everyone's health. And so it's really exciting that they're even thinking about this and taking this up. And so there is a link on my website and in my newsletter, ways that you can take action and call your legislator and let them know that you'd like them to prioritize healthy and climate-friendly food for these institutions. And also in the news last week, I wrote about eating for mood swings and how so often when we are depressed or feeling challenged, we grab food that is, you know, in the moment might seem like it's going to make us feel better, but in the long run, it's really not so good for us. And those are, you know, the fast foods, fatty foods, sugary foods, and you're much better off choosing foods that are really good for you. And of course, this week I wrote about the climate crisis and food production, how that is all at risk. And climate change is coming. We're in it. And it is already being seen by farmers and workers, the devastation and the results of some of the climate change. And this new paper that was published in One Earth, which is a journal, came out saying that one third of the world's food production will be at risk if the greenhouse gas emissions continue at their current rate. And that's scary. I mean, you know, we think of most of the food coming in this country through these big farms, monocropping and such. But the truth is the majority of people on the planet are still being fed by small family farms. And the areas that are going to mostly be impacted dramatically with climate change are in the Southeastern Asia and Africa nations, where they are already dealing with food insecurity and already are seeing the changes of climate, and they will have the least money to actually deal with some of those problems. So we all know we really have to take climate change seriously. Thank God we have a new administration that is doing that. But we all can do our own work. And a lot of that, one way we can make a difference is thinking about the foods that we purchase, the foods that we support, the people who are growing it, and to just, you know, become aware of climate change and our impact. Everything we do impacts our global footprint, and we have ways of reducing that. And so we can all look at that on our own personal level and try to make a change. And I want to share with you my recipe. As many of you know, I've been working in our family business, Jarf Studio. We do high-end architectural metal and glass, which is a big shift from my daily food world that I was in. But COVID just kind of changed all that and turned it upside down, since the school no longer wanted to add more plants into their school lunch program right now, since they're doing the bag lunches. So I had time, and I've been working in my husband's business, which has really been wonderful, but it means I have less time to cook dinner when I come home. And so I really feel that impact of getting dinner on the table quickly. And, you know, tips of how to make things ahead of time and use your freezer and freeze them are all great. And so, you know, when I can come up with a recipe that's a casserole where I can eat only half and then save another half for another meal, it's really great. This is a baked pasta bolognese. That's wonderful. And the bolognese, of course, is made with mushrooms, not meat. And the bechamel sauce that I put on top of this was made with macadamia nuts. They were really good. It was the first time I actually made a cream sauce with macadamia nuts. I usually use cashews, but I didn't have cashews. So one thing I want to also just encourage you all, when you're in the kitchen and you're cooking and you don't have the right ingredient, doesn't mean to abort the to do with them. So a pound of pasta of your choice, any type of penne or smaller noodle will work really well in this. 3/4 cup of dried mushrooms, 1 onion chopped, 8 ounces of baby Bella mushrooms. Those are fresh mushrooms, and 2 portobello mushrooms, 3 tablespoons of tomato paste, 1 can of fire roasted tomatoes, 1/4 cup of extra virgin olive oil, 1/4 cup of Marsala wine, 1 cup of macadamia nuts, 2 teaspoons dried oregano and 1 teaspoon dried basil, 3 tablespoons minced garlic, 1 cup of walnuts, 1/4 cup of red pepper flakes, and that's optional if you want your pasta to have a little bite to it. 3 tablespoons of Italian parsley chopped, 1.5 teaspoon salt, 1 tablespoon tamari, 1/2 teaspoon pepper, 1/2 teaspoon nutmeg, paprika for garnish, and 1/4 teaspoon of white pepper. And the white pepper I use in the bechamel sauce. I don't like the little black specks in there. So white pepper is good for the bechamel. So you're going to start by soaking the dried mushrooms in 1 cup of boiling water. So I just put the mushrooms into a measuring cup, covered it with boiling water, and I actually put a saucer on top to keep the mushrooms immersed because they tend to want to float up. In a separate measuring cup, I covered the macadamia nuts also with boiling water and let those soak. And I let both of those things soak while I was sauteing the mushrooms. So while those are soaking, you're going to coat the bottom of a cast iron pan or a heavy skillet or even a heavy duty pot with olive oil. You're going to saute the onions for a few minutes until they're translucent. Add the fresh mushrooms and 2 tablespoons of the minced garlic. And cook that down for about 5 minutes so the mushrooms start getting soft. Then while that's cooking, you can drain the dried mushrooms, reserve the mushroom water, and I pulsed those in the food processor so that they were really finely chopped. And I pulsed them also with 1 tablespoon of chopped garlic. And then I added that to the skillet with the other mushrooms and cooked that down again for another 5 minutes. Added the herbs and the tomato paste to the skillet and cooked that for another 5 minutes. Then when it starts sticking, the tomato paste starts sticking to the bottom, you can deglaze the pan with 1/4 cup of Marsala wine. So you pour that in. I also added 1/2 cup of the reserved mushroom water, the can of fire roasted tomatoes, the salt, the pepper, and the tamari. And the tamari is really, it doesn't really go with Italian food, but it's an umami that kind of just adds a deep richness to the dish. So it gives it a deeper level of flavor than just adding salt. And let that all cook down for about 10 minutes. While that's cooking, you can drain the macadamia nuts. And in a food processor, you're going to pulse the nuts until they become a paste. And then add 1 cup of water into the food processor and continue pulsing it, scraping down the sides and pulsing it some more until you get a really smooth cream. And then you're going to add the nutmeg, 1/2 teaspoon salt, and the white pepper to that. Pulse it again to mix it up and taste it. And if you'd like, you can add a little more nutmeg or a little more salt. It's really a personal taste thing at that point for the bechamel sauce. So when everything's ready, I didn't say cook the pasta. That's obvious. You're going to cook the pasta in some boiling water, al dente. Drain that. But you want to cook it al dente because remember, this is still going to go in the oven. And you can preheat your oven to 350 degrees so it will be ready to go for the casserole to go in. So when the pasta is drained and ready, I took my Pyrex casserole dish. I covered the bottom of it with 1 cup of the bolognese sauce, added the pasta on top put the remaining bolognese sauce on top and just mix the pasta right there in the casserole dish. Then I poured all of the macadamia cream on top, smoothed it out. And then I made a crisscross pattern with the paprika just as garnish, as a decoration. If you go on my website, you can see that. And if you actually take a knife on an angle across the casserole dish and sprinkle the paprika, it will make lines of the paprika. So you have a knife, you know, the extra paprika goes onto the knife, but just a thin line will go onto the casserole dish. And so I made a crisscross pattern using my knife and the paprika, and then sprinkled it with some of the fresh parsley and baked it in the oven for about 20 minutes, just until the bechamel sauce starts to firm up, but you don't want to dry it out. And so that just about 20 minutes, that's it. And then it was delicious. And, you know, it can easily serve six people. And I highly recommend you make it. You won't be disappointed. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest, Carrie Gillam. She's the author and investigative journalist behind the new book, The Monsanto Papers. Carrie has more than 30 years of experience covering food and agricultural policies and practices, including 17 years as a senior correspondent for Reuters International News Service. She has specialty knowledge regarding the rise of biotech crop technology and the associated rise in pervasive pesticide use in our farming and food production system. Carrie has won several industry awards for her work and has been recognized as a leading global expert on corruption in the agricultural chemical industry. Her first book, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer and the Corruption of Science, was released in October 2017, and it won the coveted Rachel Carson Book Award from the Society of Environmental Journalists, as well as two other literary awards. Carrie's been asked to speak all over the world about food and agricultural matters, including before the European Parliament in Brussels, the World Forum for Democracy in Strasbourg, and to public officials, organizations, and conferences in the US, Canada, Australia, Argentina, France, and the Netherlands. She's also been invited to lecture at many universities. She served as a consultant on and participant in several documentary TV and film pieces, including the award-winning Poisoning Paradise, which is a documentary that was released in June of 2019 by actor Pierce Bronson and his wife, Keely Bronson. And so it's just a thrill to have you here, Carrie. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much. I'm hungry now for that dish. I was frantically trying to write down the recipe.
Well, it's on my website, so you can get it there. But of course, I'm happy to send it to you too. I'd like to always start with my guests to just ask your own personal story. How did you become an investigative journalist specializing in food and agriculture? How did your path lead you here?
Well, it was not by choice. I mean, I guess it was, but it's certainly nothing that I planned or envisioned. I've been a business reporter for a long time. I always knew I wanted to be a journalist. I always knew I wanted to, dig into things that people, you know, might want to know about, things that people might want to be hiding and might need somebody to dig in. I'm pretty tenacious by nature, and somebody who likes to take on a challenge, I guess. If somebody tells me, no, don't do it, it means I really want to do it usually. So I seem well suited for the task. I was writing about the banking industry based in Atlanta, covering some of the big banks based in the Southeast. And Reuters asked me to move to Kansas and start covering food and farming. And Reuters is one of the biggest news organizations in the world. I think the Kansas Bureau was their smallest bureau in the world, probably. And but there was a very big company just up the road in St. Louis, Monsanto, that had just, this was in the 1990s, in the late 90s, Monsanto had just introduced genetically engineered crops that were designed to be tolerant of Monsanto's Roundup herbicides. These Roundup ready crops could be sprayed directly with the herbicide and they would not die. And it was quite a revolutionary moment for agriculture, particularly, you know, row crop farming in the heartland. And that was a big thing for me to start writing about and learning about. And the other companies, Dow and DuPont and Syngenta, were all really trying to jump on this new trend in agriculture. So I moved to Kansas and been here ever since. I was actually born here, so it, you know, made sense, I guess, to get back to my roots. And I, you know, I wasn't sure I was going to love it at first, but I really have, over all of these years, come to really respect farming and to recognize how profoundly important it is, you know, to all of us, to our lives, to the planet, right? To the health of our families and our children. So I feel really blessed, I guess, and grateful to have been able to do this for the last however many years, 20 some years now.
Yeah. Well, you're doing a big service because we all need to know, and they are so good at covering everything up. And that's, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because I've been following them for years and, you know, hearing about, you know, the minute somebody starts confronting them, they infiltrate, right? They have this way of infiltrating everything so that they get their way. And it's infuriating, and it's, you know, it's unbelievable how manipulative the whole situation is. So in your first book, Whitewash, which was an expose on Monsanto and the health risks of Roundup, maybe you can talk a little bit about that first book and then how this next book, The Monsanto Papers, kind of is a perfect follow-up to that book.
Yeah, so Whitewash, the publishing house Island Press, it's a publisher that focuses a lot on environmental issues, approached me in 2015, actually. And I was working at Reuters, and they said, you know, you've been covering and writing a lot of really explosive stories about, you know, this chemical and Monsanto and this saga. And would you perhaps write a book, put it all into a book? And I thought, no, goodness, no, no one wants to read a book about a pesticide, for goodness sakes. But I then left Reuters at the end of 2015 and started writing this book in 2016. And as you said, it was published in 2017. But the book really was the culmination of, you know, all of my, by that time, nearly 20 some years of reporting on this industry. And I called it Whitewash. It was the only thing that was the title, the only title that ever came to mind, because that's what I experienced. That's what I saw firsthand over and over and over and over again, was the whitewashing, the hiding, the glossing over of the dangers and the risks of this very widely used herbicide. Roundup, glyphosate-based herbicides, are the most widely used herbicides in the world. And Monsanto's marketing of this chemical and all of the different tactics that they employed to push this chemical into the marketplace led it to become, as I said, to supplant many other herbicides. And it's that wide use that made it so dangerous, and that created the environmental problems as well as the health problems. And I saw repeated examples of the company trying to manipulate, you know, consumer information, manipulate the scientific record, manipulate the regulatory actions to keep this chemical from being restricted, and to keep the ability of farmers to spray it directly on food crops, so that what we all experience now is we're consuming food, and the livestock is consuming food that has residues of this chemical in it. And we then have residues of this chemical in our own bodies. So the book really was very heavily based on scientific data, scientific reports, and a lot of freedom of information documents that I was able to obtain from different federal agencies, and also that had been obtained from state universities, academic emails and things like that. So yeah, I was considered an expose, I guess. It got a lot of attention. So it brought me to the European Parliament to testify, and I was asked to speak to, you know, regulators and consumers and media in many different countries around the world after that book came out. And it did win 3 awards. And Monsanto certainly did not like the book at all. They did not really find anything in it to challenge necessarily, because it's all, you know, lock solid truth. Fact based on facts and data and documents, but they certainly didn't like it at all.
Of course. Yeah. You know, when you talk about that chemical, I know that it's found in mother's breast milk. You know, that it's really in everything. Like you said, even if you try to avoid it, if you eat animals that are eating all the animal feed, has that residue in it as well. Can you share some examples of some of their tactics, the infiltration they did? I mean, like we all have heard about the revolving door in Congress and, you know, in our government. But then there's also, you know, revolving doors in scientific journals. You know, there was that French doctor that, you know, did the experiments with the rats and, you know, all those horrible tumors. I'm forgetting his name. I'm sure you know it. But, you know, all those tumors with the rats and, you know, and they ruined his career. And then, you know, 10 years later, I think it got apologized. But at that point, you know, you can't make up for lost time. And I mean, the things that they did were just so despicable. Maybe you could share a few examples.
Yeah, and you use the word despicable. That's a you know, word probably a lot of people would use. Just yesterday, I was sitting watching. It was a virtual court hearing, but it was through Zoom. But I was watching a federal court hearing in which the judge, Judge Chhabria, he has been overseeing the litigation that's going on around the U.S. for several years now, and he oversaw one of the Roundup trials. So he is very familiar with the evidence. And he said yesterday in the hearing, Monsanto's conduct, you know, has been very bad. The evidence, I think he used the word crass conduct. He's spoken out about them before, but he's made the point multiple times that the evidence is very clear that Monsanto did not care if its product was causing people cancer or not. They did not care to explore or understand that. They spent their time and their money and their effort trying to hide and discredit and invalidate all of the evidence that was coming out that this could cause cancer. And that's why you've seen these multi-billion dollar judgments against Monsanto. However, so what you were asking, some of the examples, you know, the manipulation of the scientific record is one that I find the most stunning, I guess. And I'll give an example. I wrote this story up about, I think I called it praise and polo shirts or something for ghostwriting the study. But there was a very important paper that Monsanto wanted to be published in the scientific record at the end of the 1990s. And this was because there were a lot of independent scientific studies coming out showing that their glyphosate-based Roundup products looked to be genotoxic. And there was a concern about them causing cancer. And this concern was building. And Monsanto wanted to shut that down. And so they needed a really heavy scientific paper to be published that they could give to regulators that would say, this stuff does not cause cancer, doesn't cause reproductive harm. You know, this is really safe. You can, you know, this stuff can be spread everywhere and it's fine. And so they set about ghostwriting a paper. And they had, there were different authors that were going to be on this paper who didn't work for Monsanto. And so they would look like, you know, this was a totally independent, unbiased paper. But you can see from the internal emails, all of these conversations that Monsanto scientists are having. And they're saying, you know, gosh, we spent so much time on this. This is, I think it was like 3 years, if I'm remembering this correctly, that they worked on this paper and all of this time and effort. And they're celebrating because the paper's finally done, this independent paper that they, Monsanto, spent so much time working on. And they talk about how it's going to be great for their defense of glyphosate around the world. And they're going to give it to regulators. And they're going to celebrate this great independent paper they've created with commemorative polo shirts. You know, that is silly. But the hypocrisy in that and just sort of the blatant deception, I think, just strikes me so much. But you see that played out in example after example after example. There's another one with GMO crops where one of the Monsanto scientists has written a paper and he's looking for an independent academic to put their name on the paper. And he's having a hard time finding somebody who will just slap their name on something they didn't write, is what he tells his colleagues. So you see things like that. And what you described, attacking different scientists personally, trying to discredit them, trying to smear and harass them, trying to smear and harass people like me, or other journalists who write about, you know, the scientific research that shows associations to cancer. And then manipulation and collusion, really, with regulators. You see that in multiple examples through these internal emails. You know, these aren't anecdotal things that people are relating to you. It's not sort of a he said, she said. These are Monsanto's own words that really have exposed their deception to the world.
Mm-hmm. And how did the courts get those records? Like, I'm surprised Monsanto didn't just erase them all. You know, that would be more their style, right? To hide all that evidence.
It always is interesting, isn't it, that, you know, I've talked to some of these lawyers who say they find it so surprising that these corporate actors still put down in writing in emails and text messages and things that can be captured and exposed at a later date. They still put all this down in writing. But these were obtained, a lot of these documents that were made at my second book were obtained through litigation. These were the people that sued starting in 2015, saying that I have non-Hodgkin lymphoma and I, you know, had lots of exposure to Roundup. And so I am suing Monsanto for not telling me, not warning of the risks of that. And through discovery, the lawyers are able to obtain these internal documents. And in the Roundup litigation, they obtained over, you know, 10 million documents from Monsanto. And that's why you saw three trials and you saw three jury verdicts in favor of the plaintiffs. And you now see Monsanto's owner, Bayer, offering to pay over $11 billion in all to settle these cases.
Yeah. So let's talk about Lee Johnson's case. Was that the first? That was not the first lawsuit against Monsanto, obviously, but it was the first one that they lost. Is that correct?
Lee Johnson was the first to go to trial. Yeah, he was not the first lawsuit to be filed, but he was very early on in the filings. But his case became the first one to go to trial because Lee was expected to die. Very quickly. The doctors gave him 18 months to live when he was diagnosed with this form of non-Hodgkin lymphoma that is just really a horrifying, horrifying disease. It's a type of non-Hodgkin lymphoma that manifests in the skin. And so the lesions and the cancerous tumors are actually seen on the skin and weep and bleed and ooze you know, in many places, it looks like someone's put a cigar out, you know, on his flesh. And it's just in extreme pain all the time. I spent a lot of time with him. His story is the makings of the Monsanto papers of my second book. And I really tried to make that book a very personal story, I guess, about Lee and his family and his struggle with cancer and his struggle to hold Monsanto accountable. And the lawyers that helped him along the way and their kind of sometimes crazy little twists and turns and strategies to get his case to trial. But he did, he, you know, went to trial, he won, and he actually is still alive today, which has surprised all of the doctors. And
amazing. I was going to ask you about that because I did not hear about him dying. But maybe we can just backtrack a little for my listeners that are not familiar with the lawsuit. Maybe you can share a little bit about his story. How did it come to become a national story?
Yeah. So Lee was a school groundskeeper. You know, he was a guy in his 40s. He struggled really early on in his life. He grew up without a father in his life. He, you know, was sort of a low income family and had a hard time in school and got in trouble with the law a little bit and just really struggled, but then hit his stride, you know, in his 30s and 40s and was married, had two little boys of his own, had this great job that he loved as a groundskeeper for the Benicia School District in Northern California, and, you know, was working really hard to, you know, provide for his family. And part of his job was to spray, you know, weed killers, Roundup, and then another one called Ranger Pro, also made by Monsanto, also based on this chemical glyphosate. And, you know, he wore protective gear, but he had a couple of accidents where a tank sprayer, the first one was a tank sprayer that he was using that was mounted on the back of a truck, became disengaged, the hose became unattached, and there was a large fountain of this chemical that sort of was spewing into the air, and he was jumping in there trying to, you know, close it off and to keep the chemical from running down into a waterway, and really trying to, you know, protect everybody else, I guess, from this chemical problem. And he just got absolutely doused in it. And it was after that, not too long after that, that he started to see these odd lesions sort of coming up on his skin. He tried to figure out what was going on, and you know, the saga sort of continues, because it took him a long time to really understand and realize that it was this exposure to this chemical. You know, he kept spraying it for a while, even after he developed the cancer. And he called Monsanto at one point trying to get answers. He was concerned, should he keep spraying the chemical? Nobody ever called him back. You know, and he finally connected then with a law firm out of Virginia, and thus his case, you know, got underway. But it's really been a painful journey for him, and he was so saddened to be told he wasn't going to be there to raise his own two boys. You know, that was really important to him, has been important to him, and he's been battling this cancer now for, you know, quite a bit longer than people expected, and he's getting weary of the battle, he tells me.
Yeah, it's hard, really hard. So what made this case different than all the other cases that were brought up, that actually made this one come to a head and Monsanto lost? How, you know, what was different about this case?
So Lee's case really became historic, you know, and did sort of become, you know, a changing event, because it was the first, because his trial brought to light, put a spotlight on these internal Monsanto documents. A lot of them were laid out at trial as evidence that, you know, not only did the lawyers put out scientific experts to talk about the science that showed that this caused cancer, but they introduced all of this evidence that Monsanto had been deceiving people and manipulating regulators. And when the jury looked at that, you know, they were completely outraged, and they talked about it afterwards. And I talk about it, you know, a few jurors in my book, but they found the evidence overwhelming, and it was a unanimous jury verdict. And it was his case because there were media from around the world that watched that and that attended that and wrote about that. And, you know, of course, I was one of them, but there were many, many others. And it really did create new questions, I guess, by regulatory agencies and consumers. There are a lot of places around the US and the world that are saying, we're going to ban this chemical now that we have this information. We don't believe what the company's been telling us anymore. We know it's harmful to people. We know the research shows us that it's harmful to the environment, and we want to make a change. And so you've seen springing from his trial this sort of groundswell of more educated analysis, I guess, of the risk and reward calculus here. And, you know, you're seeing people respond all around the world. And you're also seeing the company, you know, fight back pretty hard.
Right. Well, right after, actually, was it during the trial or right after that Bayer bought Monsanto? Did Bayer know what they were buying when they bought Monsanto? Did they know they were going to incur all these lawsuits?
That is such a crazy part, right, of the story, because Bayer, the big German pharmaceutical company, bought Monsanto, and they closed on the purchase right as the Lee Johnson trial was starting in June of 2018. They paid $63 billion to buy Monsanto. And a lot of people like me were saying, boy, do you not see the train wreck right ahead of you? I mean, do you not know what is coming down? Because we see it coming. And sure enough, when the jury verdict came down in August, 2 months later, awarded Lee Johnson $289 million and said unanimously, yes, the weight of evidence shows this stuff causes cancer. The stock price of Bayer plummeted. Investors were outraged. They drove that share price down. It wiped out billions of dollars in market capitalization for Bayer immediately. The company was stunned, and they've been hit by two other trials. The third trial, the plaintiffs were awarded over $2 billion. So, it's really shaken up Bayer. They've continued to maintain that all of these juries are wrong, and that all of the scientists, who are saying this shows it causes cancer are wrong, and pretty much everybody's wrong, and we should believe them. And the EPA, we should say, and many other regulatory agencies continue to back the company's position and say that it doesn't cause cancer. Wait a minute.
Backtrack a minute. Our EPA is still saying that? I thought they recognized that glyphosate was a carcinogen, and I know there's certainly bills to try to get it off the market. I've certainly shared those petitions all over the place. Where is that at right now? Because that I find that surprising that the EPA still, with all this evidence, is not coming forward saying that it is carcinogenic and let's get it off the market. Who has infiltrated the EPA? That would be the next question.
Oh my goodness. The EPA is a story in and of itself. So back in the 1980s, the EPA's own scientists said, from the data we're looking at, it looks like this causes cancer, and we should classify it as such. But as you'll read in Whitewash in my first book, you can see Monsanto fought that bitterly, and they worked for years to overturn that scientific opinion inside the EPA, and they were successful in getting the top level people at the EPA to side with them. And so ever since the 1990s, the EPA's position has been this doesn't cause cancer. And they continue to hold that position. As recently as it was a couple of days ago that the EPA filed a motion, or was it a motion? It was a declaration. Maybe it was a motion. I can't remember now. But it was in federal court, a filing in response to a lawsuit seeking to have glyphosate-based products removed from the market. And they reiterated again that, in their opinion, the weight of evidence shows that there is not a human health risk associated with these herbicides. They do admit, too, there being some ecological risk, and they're saying they're taking a look at this, and they may need to put some restrictions on it because of the environmental impacts. But they continue to maintain that there is no cancer risk associated with this product.
And I'm sure someone has. Who has looked into all the members of the EPA and what their ties to Monsanto are?
Well, I mean, what you see when I wrote about this in both of these books, you see evidence that there are a lot of really close connections, and there's a revolving door element to it. But, for example, the guy who ran the cancer review for the EPA, a guy named Jess Rowland, who was in charge of looking at the evidence and putting out the EPA position, Monsanto talked about him as a friend that they could rely on, and that hopefully they could use to help defend, that was their word, in defense of glyphosate. And after he put out that position, he retired and went and got some sort of consulting arrangement in the chemical industry. And we don't know, because he won't tell us specifically what he's doing. You also have an example where the EPA, there was another agency in our US government that wanted to do a toxicity review of Monsanto's herbicides. This is called the ATSDR, part of Health and Human Services. And you saw Monsanto, from the internal documents, rush to the EPA and say, please help us stop this. We want to stop this review. we're afraid they might think this causes cancer. And, you know, the EPA immediately, you see, I wrote about this, you see, like the same day they respond to Monsanto and jump in and help get this review stopped, delayed for several years by this other agency. So, and even in this filing with the federal court that they wrote a couple of days ago, you see them talk about, and I know this is part of their job, but it still seems, you know, they talk about how disruptive it would be to take glyphosate off the market, disruptive. And they talk about the investments that people have made in these GMO seeds, the crops that are designed to be sprayed with glyphosate. And that's a consideration that the EPA makes, is the economic impact of a decision like taking a chemical off the market. What is the economic impact going to be to farmers, to companies that sell these products, you know, to trade, that sort of thing. So human health is one thing they look at, but it's not the only thing they look at, certainly.
Yeah. Well, the Environmental Protection Agency is not supposed to look at economic impact. That's not, they're supposed to look at the environmental health impact. And then we have the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, who was elected governor of the year by the biotech companies, you know, who we saw did not do a very good job under the Obama administration. Now here he is back underneath the, under the Biden administration. What are your thoughts about Tom Vilsack?
You know, Tom Vilsack is one of many, I guess, of his ilk, right? I mean, these people are part of the system. And I don't know that I would say that, you know, assign them an evil character necessarily or something. I think they're born and bred and raised in this system where corporate money, you know, corporate power and greed and profit and, you know, the drive of capitalism and everything, like that's what it's about. And all of this stuff about human health and environmental health, and that's sort of something wonky over here on the side, but it's really about driving economic growth and jobs and agricultural production and all of that sort of thing. That's important, certainly, but my argument would be you have to really look at the risks as well as the rewards, and there has to be proper balance. And when you have so much money in Washington, D.C., and you have these very powerful companies who are working to protect their profits, you know, telling our lawmakers what they should believe and what they should do, and telling our government appointed, you know, our politically appointed heads of these agencies, like head of the USDA, head of the EPA, head of the FDA, telling them what to do, how to look at the science. You know, it's a corrupt system, and it just is. And until we get the money out of Washington, we get a completely, you know, new way of doing business. This business as usual is not going to serve the public. And there's, you know, decades of evidence. It's not a partisan thing. It's not Republican or Democrat. It's right. The way Washington works. It doesn't work for the people very well. And I think all of your listeners probably know that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the problems about these progressive radio shows. They're talking to progressive people who understand that. We need to get this to other people who really, you know, think the system is working for them. So the book, your reporting is based on nearly unfettered access to Lee and his lawyers and more than 80,000 pages of court exhibits and other documents. Did you discover anything in the course of that research that stands out or surprised you?
Goodness. I guess there are a lot of things, right? I mean, one thing, which is separate, I guess, from looking at Monsanto, you know, I've looked at Monsanto, I've covered and researched this company since 1998, so it's hard to surprise me, I guess, at this point. But I was really intrigued by the mass tort system in the U.S. And this book, the Monsanto Papers, really delves into that a little bit as well. So you see Monsanto and the agricultural industry and Lee and dealing with cancer. But I really was fascinated, and I wanted readers to be with me on that journey about learning about the mass tort system in America. It's so fascinating how these lawyers that do this work, you know, some of them are pegged as ambulance chasers and exploiting people, or maybe all of them are, but what I found is that there's a lot of good, bad, and ugly in how this works. But when the regulators aren't doing their job to protect the public, you don't really have anything else other than these lawyers and the strategies that they employ, the hoops that they jump through, the different tactics that they have to, you know, try to pursue. And this case in the Monsanto situation, it was really, really tricky and compelling. I think a lot of the things that they had to go through because Monsanto was so powerful and was really trying to keep its documents secret and was trying to shut down this litigation without it ever going to trial. They really did not want to go to trial. And mm-hmm. you saw some of the lawyers, like this one lawyer in Lee's case, he wasn't actually involved in Lee's case at the time, but he decides that these documents need to be shown to the world, even though, you know, the judge has not yet actually said that he can do this, and he figures out a way that he can, you know, just past midnight on one hot August night, how he can get these documents out into the hands of regulators around the world and consumers and to media. And, you know, it was fascinating to me to watch these lawyers at work and try to share that with the public.
Mm-hmm. And was this a old seasoned law firm, or were these young, more progressive lawyers that wanted to, you know, kind of make a name for them? What, you know, what mix of lawyers were you dealing with?
It was really an eclectic group, this team that came together to lead this roundup litigation. So you do have sort of the old veteran, I shouldn't call them old, but you know, veteran, having done this for many decades now. None of the lawyers had ever taken on a pesticide company or taken on Monsanto. They were, you know, oil and gas or pharmaceutical. But you had really young, just wet behind the ears, still kind of up and coming. And then you had, you know, the veteran, and they came together and had some disagreements along the way, weren't always on the same page, and fought it out. But through some twists and turns and a near fatal accident on the eve of trial, you know, the final trial team came together, and you see history made.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So after having covered the trial so closely, how do you see the court system differently? Are legal cases the best way to hold corrupt companies accountable?
You know, I, in my perfect world, you know, I would say no. I mean, I would say I wish we had lawmakers and regulators that would jump in and really hold these companies accountable. We don't. I mean, what you see is, you know, this has been so long ago. I wrote about this in Whitewash, but it happened so long ago. I mean, Monsanto at one point many years ago was caught bribing government officials in another country. And, you know, it was known and it was established. And the fine, you know, they were forced to pay like a fine, you know, of $1 million or something. I mean, it was a very small little slap on the wrist.
Slap on the wrist, right.
And you see that with other companies over and over and over again. It's a cost of doing business. It doesn't change what they do. It doesn't change the dangers that they pose to consumers with the products they put out there. The only thing that ever actually has been shown to change or force a company into change is the court system. And these lawyers and these law firms who sometimes spend years putting these cases together and spend millions of their own dollars, they don't get paid by these clients. They only get paid if they win at trial and they win judgments. And, you know, they put their lives and their careers and their financial situations on the line to try to hold companies accountable. And you've seen that in many different industries and many different injuries that people have suffered through, you know, medical device malfunction, you know, products that don't work as effectively or as they're supposed to, and that have side effects that are very dangerous. You've seen this in glyphosate. You're seeing it in other pesticide litigation that's going on right now. It's a very unfortunate part of our system. Nobody.
Although you would think with like the lawsuit where you said, you know, Bayer has to pay $2 billion to one of the lawsuits. It's like, that's not enough money to make them want to pull the product from the market. I mean, it's amazing to me that these huge numbers are still not enough to make them pull it.
Because if you make billions of dollars a year, every year off the product, then no, paying out 10, 11, 12, $13 billion. I mean, yeah, I mean, it bites, but it certainly doesn't break the company at all. So, but meanwhile, you know, the science keeps building. I wanted to share with your listeners, I just got this across my desk. This was published yesterday by the University of Michigan. It's a new study that's come out and just building on many others that have found sort of similar that if you have this chemical glyphosate, which is, you know, the main ingredient in Roundup, in your body when you're pregnant, there's a significant association with preterm births. Women who are exposed to glyphosate have more preterm births. And we know that premature birth is not a good thing for the health of the baby. So, you know, this is coming out of the University of Michigan, and I see studies like this almost every week.
Right.
On and on and on.
And then also we see that as the pests are becoming more used to the pesticide, it's not doing the same work that it used to do. So they're now having to make the chemicals stronger. And, you know, I've heard about, you know, them mixing Agent Orange in with the glyphosate to create something new. And what's your take on this new chemical that's coming out?
Well, yeah. And this is, you know, again, I wrote about this in Whitewash. This is a pesticide treadmill. I mean, we knew, our scientists warned the EPA and warned Monsanto back in the 2000s, the late 90s and the 2000s. If you push the use of this so widely that you're telling farmers they can spray this over an entire field of growing crops, and you're doing this over and over again, weeds are going to become resistant. It's just how Mother Nature works. And so as weeds become more resistant, you're going to have to use more and more chemical to actually control these weeds. And that's what we've seen happen. And so now what Monsanto and all these other companies are doing is they're saying, yeah, keep using glyphosate products, but add on 2,4-D, add on dicamba, add on these older herbicides. 2,4-D is the one you're referring to that was part of Agent Orange that Monsanto actually manufactured. But so our farmers are being told, just use more and more types, and just keep putting it on these food crops. And, you know, so our FDA and our USDA that look at our food for residues of these pesticides, I have internal documents where they're telling each other, be prepared. We're going to see huge increases in these chemical residues in foods in the upcoming years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've talked a lot about all the food allergies, and especially with wheat. Right? Because they spray Roundup on wheat to dry it out. And so all these people now that have wheat allergies, you know, this is not even scientific. This is just like my gut saying, hey, you know, instead of it being the wheat, maybe you're allergic to the glyphosate. I mean, that, you know, they spray it on after they harvest it. So it's not like it's even out there in the rain to be washed off. It's on the wheat when they process the wheat. And, you know, I first became aware of this at Terra Madre, at a slow food conference in Italy, where the Italians were talking about how, you know, wheat was grown in Rome and south of Rome, basically mostly in Sicily, that you couldn't grow wheat north of Rome because of the climate. And now the majority of the wheat is being grown up in Canada and the Dakotas, where it's, you know, a cold climate. And the Italians were like, how's that possible? And then they found out that it's possible because they dry it out with spraying the pesticide glyphosate on it. And so, you know, when people have problems with wheat, that's why a lot of times if they're eating wheat that's grown in Italy, you know, people say that they don't have the allergy in Europe, you know, that they really only have it here. And so, you really have to look at the quality of the ingredients. And that's why so much of my work is really trying to promote organic when I can, you know, trying to encourage people to eat that way, because it's the only safeguard we have to, you know, to cleaner quality food. And yes, it's not perfect, but it's certainly better than non-organic. And unfortunately, it's, you know, most of the time it's more expensive, and it's not fair because everyone's entitled to clean food.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah.
Yeah. The wheat thing is really, I wrote about that in chapter 4 of Whitewash. I write about the pesticide residues in food, and the wheat is alarming because it is applied so late in the process, because it is applied as a harvest aid to dry it out, as you said. You know, the residues, I mean, I remember an academic at one of the universities, I can't ever remember if it's North or South Dakota University, State University, analyzing flour samples and being just stunned, he said, to find glyphosate residues in all the flour that he tested.
Yeah.
I should say, I've been heartened to see in recent years, you know, I wrote about that in Whitewash, it's become more well known. And there are a lot of milling companies now that are saying to farmers, we're not going to take your wheat if you spray it with glyphosate, you know, so if you want to do that, you're not going to be a customer of ours. You're going to find somewhere else to sell your grain. So, you know, that I think is important. And that's because, you know, consumers are becoming more aware, they're changing their buying habits, they're demanding that manufacturers be more responsible in this realm. So it does have the ability to change what happens on the ground in farms, I think, yeah, as more people become aware and educated.
And we really, I mean, education is so important, because we also have people, like I've seen wheat advertised non-GMO. Well, wheat's not genetically modified, you know, that's not one of the GMO crops, but it's still sprayed with glyphosate, you know? So it's like people, they use these trendy words to trick people, you know? So you say, oh, it's non-GMO. Great. Well, then it's a good one. Well, if it doesn't say organic, it's not, you know? And so, you know, learning which products are most contaminated is really important in order to safeguard yourself. Because yes, you know, GMO is certainly another concern that people have. But the glyphosate issue is really, you know, something can be sprayed heavily with glyphosate and still be non-GMO, you know, so.
That is true. That is a good point. Yes.
Yeah. So Carrie, we are almost out of time. Can you share with my listeners how they would find you and where they can get your book? And I will too, of course.
Thank you. You can follow me on Twitter, Carrie Gillam, CareyGillam, or my website, carriegillam.com. I put a lot of my articles there. I also write for The Guardian news outlet. You can find my articles.
Guardian's there. Great. Good.
Guardian and Carrie Gillam. You can find a list of my work. And I do research now. After leaving Reuters, I joined US Right to Know, which is a nonprofit group.
I interviewed Stacey Malkin.
My colleague.
Yeah, she's been on. Yeah.
So, you know, we do Freedom of Information Act requests and get documents and data and share them with the public and other reporters and lawmakers, yeah, and anybody who's interested. And so come
US on. Right to Know is great. And so also just know, if you have new things that you want to get out there, please send them to me, because I will, you know, share them with my audience as well. Great. But thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you on, and everyone out there who's been joining us, thank you so much. My guest has been Carrie Gillam, and her book, The Monsanto Papers, is really an expose, worth reading. So check it out.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.